Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, August 29th, our last show of August, at least our last Thursday of August. This is day number 241 of 2013, and tonight we're going to do our weekly history class. Leslie Eastman is going to be joining us tonight. Also, Barry Jacobson is going to be checking in, and we're going to do a little history. It has something to do with Cleopatra, so I think you're going to enjoy it a great deal, and I'll let Leslie tell you all about it here in just a second. My book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, available in print as well as Kindle. You know, you can get it through your own account at Amazon if you have one of those, but you can also go to the website, our website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, and you can get the book right there. We will even dedicate the book for you. I always tell the story of these people who send us letters, and they dedicate the book to us, and it's something that we enjoy a great deal. So CubanosInWisconsin.com, check it out. Get yourself a copy of the book. We will dedicate the book to you, and then I'm sure you'll send me a letter, like a lot of other people have, telling me that it was an enjoyable book. We're going to take a break, and we've got Leslie Eastman right around the corner. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let's say hello to Leslie Eastman. How are you, Leslie?
Happy to be joining you for another fun Thursday night, Silvio. It promises to be an exciting one, too.
Well, I understand Elizabeth Taylor is joining us tonight, or is it Cleopatra? Which one?
Well, you know, in Cleopatra, you get a variety of personalities because she is one of those iconic images that shapeshifts with each generation. And definitely explore some recent revelations based on some research, and we'll get Barry Jacobson's savvy military history perspective on one of the greatest battles in history.
Excellent. And we have it on this day in history, which is just absolutely perfect. It's actually not today, but tomorrow is the anniversary of the death of Cleopatra, or the murder of Cleopatra. I guess there's a little controversy on that. So that's great timing, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it's amazing how well that tied in. You know, traditionally and very iconically, her death is thought to be a suicide, to follow Anthony into the halls of Hades in eternal love, denying Octavian the thrill of dragging her through the streets in a triumph. But we have a forensic scientist who took a look at the data, a look at the history and the archaeology currently available, and came to some very different conclusions. And we'll share those conclusions with you. And not to say it's going to change anybody's mind. I think the history presented is such a mythic one that we're not going to change anybody's opinion. But it's interesting to get a criminal science perspective.
Absolutely. Well, let's say hello to Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am good. How are you, Silvio and Leslie?
How is
wonderful, now that
West
you're joining
Coast,
us.
Yeah, now that you're joining us. Now, let's put to rest the rumor, Leslie. Are you really wearing a Cleopatra outfit tonight, or is that
But I am part of an historical group, and I'm actually having one handcrafted for me by a woman I'm hoping to have on as a guest. She's a wonderful seamstress and really creative at specialty costuming. She does a lot of the historical reenactment costuming, especially for the group Barry and I belong to. And she is redesigning Elizabeth Taylor's red dress in the early scene of the 1963 classic Cleopatra. So eventually I'm going to be looking amazingly like the Diva Taylor.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to that. When we do a video show, we're definitely going to ask you to wear that.
Well, I'm going to definitely have some photographs taken and posted in all the usual places. So hopefully
some of our fans will enjoy that. Yeah, we look forward to that. But we've got Barry on as well. Barry, before we get to the topic, obviously Syria is a major problem. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. You know, I know we've got a lot to cover, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on this very, very serious topic. And Barry, I've got an article coming out at American Thinker tomorrow about Syria, and I mentioned three things or three problems that President Obama has. Number one, no popular support here in the United States, meaning the American people are not supporting the military action. Number two, he doesn't have Congress, and I think that's a big mistake. He should go to Congress. And number three, the coalition is falling apart. You know, the British Parliament rejected going to war earlier this evening. So that means that he's basically down to two things. He doesn't do anything, or he goes in solo, which is not a smart thing to do. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this Syrian experience. Barry, what are you thinking?
Well, I think we are seeing an extraordinary breakdown in American both diplomacy and influence in the world. If you remember when Bush went to war against Iraq, he had a coalition of some 30-plus nations that fell in behind him. And by the way, that was insufficient to appease Obama and the other Democrats. They thought that was going it alone is what they called that. And now Obama can't even get the British on board.
Right.
And that tells you a lot. He didn't inherit that situation. He created that situation.
Right. No, you're right. Not getting the British is a big problem.
Well, we've always had this special relationship, haven't we, with the British, where they have been sort of to us what the Gurkhas were to them during the high days of the British Empire, meaning they were loyal shock troops we could always count on. And now, you know, we can't even count on them. And I think part of it is not Obama, part of it is him, but part of it is also that we are seeing at the end of the last decade of near constant war in the Middle East with very little results, very little tangible results that most people can see. In fact, things are much worse and there's more violence than ever, more instability than ever. I think there's just this war weariness throughout the Western world where people are saying, much like at the end of World War I, that what's the point of it?
Right.
And what's the point of wasting treasure and blood on a 1,000-year-plus-year conflict that just never seems to get any better, no matter what we do?
Right. That's a very good analogy to World War I. That's an excellent. Let me ask you one more question, a military question, and then we'll get into our topic. The cruise missile. You know, a lot of us who are not in the military, we think of the cruise missile as this incredible machine, but it really has. You can do only very little with cruise missiles. I mean, I don't mean to take anything away from their importance, but it's not like all you can do is soften your opponent with missiles. But that's about all you can do, isn't it, Barry?
Well, yeah, it's in some ways even more limited than artillery. What it gives you is a pinpoint strike that can take out one target, and it better be a very important target because unlike artillery fire, it's expensive. Each cruise missile is $1.5 to $2 million. So, you know, you launch a flurry of cruise missiles against various targets, say you launch 500 cruise missiles, well, thank you, you've just wasted $1 billion. And that's not including the command and control facilities, the launch facilities, to keep the ships on station that are launching the missiles. You could be talking about $2 billion, $3 billion operation for 1 week of firing missiles. Really to very little effect.
Right, and we saw that in the late 90s, didn't we?
We did. In fact, Bill Clinton depleted our entire reserve of cruise missiles to knock out a couple of tents in the desert and I think an aspirin factory in the Sudan.
Yes.
And it's exactly. very reminiscent of Bill Clinton in the sense that the president would be doing it if he does it. And by the way, I don't think he will at this point.
Yeah.
He'll be doing it just to retrieve his own misbeguided policy, which put his own credibility in line by drawing a line in the sand he had no business making.
Right. And it's interesting, one of the British members of the British Parliament made that case in voting against the war, saying this is all about Obama protecting his credibility. There's no national security issue here. Well, anyway, we'll stay on top of this Syrian story. Very interesting story. But Leslie, let's get into our topic. We've got two great topics tonight. We're also going to be hearing from Aaron Clary at about 9:30. He'll be talking about his new book as well as the book Worthless that he wrote. So let me turn it over to Leslie. Tell us about the two topics tonight, and let's get started.
Well, I figured as we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the iconic 1963 movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, it would be worthwhile in our monthly history review to take a look at the Battle of Actium. And when I think of military battles, the first person I think of is Barry Jacobson and getting his perspective. Barry and I might disagree on the relative outcome and success of Egypt compared to Rome, but I'll bring up those points as appropriate. What I'd like to do now is kind of take people back to our Valentine's Day show and remind everyone that at one point Cleopatra seduced Antony by dressing as Venus and sailing down the river down in Tarsus, and charmed him and supported a disastrous military campaign in Parthia in about 36 BC. He then went on to a little bit more successful campaigning in 34 BC against Armenia, which was then celebrated with a triumph in the streets of Alexandria, triumph being a very Roman celebration and with very specific meanings to Romans, in which Antony and Cleopatra sat on golden thrones, and their children were given various and sundry parts of the then what was considered to be Roman Empire. And with that in mind, I'd like Barry to chime in and pick it up from there. What happened next?
Well, I'm actually going to back up a little bit. For those who aren't familiar with the situation, let me just kind of bring everybody up to speed. Julius Caesar becomes the sole ruler of the Roman Republic. It's a republic by this point and only name. And he dies in 44 BC, murdered by his enemies. And that leads to a round of civil war in which Octavian, his nephew and heir, who's a very young man at this time, and one of Caesar's older generals, Mark Antony, joined forces. And they bring to justice, if you will, at the Battle of Philippi, the men who killed Caesar, Brutus, and Cassius. And they then divide the Roman world between them. They have a third partner. It's called the Triumvirate, meaning rule of three. And Marcus Lepidus, another general, is sort of the junior of the three, and he very quickly gets edged out of the picture. But they basically divide the Roman world between the two of them, with Octavian ruling the western part and Antony being granted the eastern part. And that's where he meets Cleopatra for the second time. He met her earlier when she was the mistress of Julius Caesar, and that was in Rome. And now he's come to the east as the new ruler of the east, and as you just mentioned, Leslie, he is quickly seduced by Cleopatra. Now, Cleopatra is a Ptolemy. Her family is the descendants of the general of Alexander the Great, who several hundred years earlier had conquered most of the Middle East. And Ptolemy, one of his generals inherited after Alexander died, Egypt, and he created a kingdom there. And this is the last of the successor, quote-unquote successors to Alexander the Great, the last of the successor kingdoms to survive. And it survived because it was geographically fairly isolated. Egypt, it has desert on three sides, Mediterranean on the northern side, so it's hard to get at. And it's enormously wealthy. And it's self-sufficient. It has enough food from the Nile to feed not only Egypt, but it can export grain to Rome as well. And in fact, it becomes the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. So the Romans have had an interest in Egypt for generations, and in fact, there's a Roman army in Egypt at this time that has more or less become Egyptian. And Antony joins forces with Cleopatra, as you just mentioned, to first campaign against the Parthians, avenging Crassus' death. Crassus was another general, died a generation earlier fighting the Parthians. And he's not very successful. But he comes back, and he ends up divorcing his wife, who is the sister of Octavian. Octavia is her name. And that begins the decline in the relations between the two men.
Yes. At that point, they fell out because of the sister. But Cleopatra was no seductress. She was definitely very mindful of Antony's position and prestige at that time. She was spoke seven languages fluently. She was very knowledgeable about associated trades, extremely intelligent woman. Her goal was essentially to recreate Alexander's empire on earth to the best of her abilities. But the second one is that she was a mother. She wanted to guarantee that a legacy would be passed on to her children. You know, so that's what Cleopatra was bringing into this relationship. And she focused on Antony because at that point, it was obvious Rome was going to be involved at that scale in Mediterranean politics. Could you tell us something, what you think about her relationship with Octavian might have been like when she was in Rome? And did anything contribute to the eventual fallout that they had?
No, in fact, that's a misunderstanding of history, that the television show Rome that was so popular years ago perpetuates. And that's the idea that Octavian actually lived in Rome at the time. He didn't. Octavian was came to Rome much later, at the very end of Julius Caesar's life. He may have met Cleopatra, but it's unlikely. And at that point, he was so young that it was, that he would have any idea or ambition to being the man he eventually became would have been surprising, because he was almost a non-entity. His only claim to fame was that he was a sickly nephew of, and not even directly nephew, he was a second nephew. Meaning his mother was Caesar's niece, so it was his great uncle, Julius. So he lucked out, if you will, and that Caesar died and left. Apparently, Caesar saw something in Octavian, and he left all of his property to him, including his name. And the name was very important because Caesar just won the civil war against Pompey, and he had a vast army. The most powerful army in the world at that point, that was devoted to Caesar and his memory, as were the majority of the Roman people. Caesar was a politician first and foremost, and had always been a champion of the common people, and that's why Antony and his famous friends, Romans, countrymen speech that followed Caesar's assassination was able to rise the people of Rome against the assassins, is that the people held Caesar in very high esteem, unlike the aristocracy that was against him. So Octavian, his dislike of Cleopatra is purely political, and he uses Rome's dislike, if you will, of strong women, which seems to be the case of Cleopatra. Rome only feared two individual people in the history of Rome. One was Hannibal, and the other was Cleopatra. They feared nations, perhaps, but they only feared two people. That says a lot about Cleopatra.
Yeah, she was definitely a presence in the Mediterranean, one of these, personalities that really transcends time. And we do get a feel for exactly how savvy she was in what she was able to accomplish. And one of the things I like to point out in discussing her is that for 200 years after her death, people in Egypt still referred to her as the Great Queen. And you find carvings with her name on it in several hundred years. So she was sort of, seen as the mother of her country. And that highlights just how, much of a presence she was through that region. And I think Carter contributes to why we still feel, her presence today.
Well, let's not overestimate her either. Cleopatra's country was dependent upon Rome. It was not an independent power that would have had any chance at all against the Romans. It had wealth, though, and it had grain. It could feed the Roman Empire. So it was very important. What made her so effective and what made her so hated by the Romans was her ability as a seductress, if you will, to charm and win over the two most powerful men in the Roman Empire. And certainly in the case of Caesar, she had a son that Antony and Cleopatra named King of Kings, and at some point before the war broke out between Antony and Octavian. And in fact, that might have been one of the reasons the war broke out, was the fear in Rome that Antony and Cleopatra were creating a kingdom out of the Eastern Roman Empire and bequeathing essentially as the legacy of Caesar to his son, Caesarion. And she seemed to have Antony wrapped around her finger, and that was another thing that enraged the Romans, that this favorite of theirs, Antony was very popular.
Yeah,
enrolled.
And actually that is a contributing factor to her potential death, which we'll get into in the second half of the show. What I'd like to do now is focus on and set up for the Battle of Actium. How did it develop, and what were the advantages and disadvantages of both sides going in?
Well, let's start with the forces available. The two men fall out, and they begin marshaling their forces. Octavian has the advantage of having Italy as a recruiting ground. We, in modern times, tend to discount the martial nature and martial prowess, if you will, of certain ethnic types, but not so in the ancient world. Romans of Italy, and basically, if not Roman, at least other Italians, were considered the best soldiers in the world. They were people that were incredibly hardy. They were tough. They were fearless. The Roman legionnaire was the soldier par excellence of the ancient world. He had become what the Spartans were in the ancient Greek world, though far more numerous. And Octavian had access to far more of them because he controlled Italy and the West. So that was his advantage. He also had a second advantage, which was, though his navy was about the same size as that of Cleopatra and Antony, he had an amazing man at his side named Marcus Agrippa. And Agrippa was both his friend and his admiral, and had already won his spurs, if you will, fighting against Sextius Pompeius, who was a son of Pompey the Great, who had continued the war after his father died. And as basically a naval pirate down by Sicily, and in the great naval battle off Sicily, Agrippa defeated the navy of Pompey. So Agrippa was quite an accomplished admiral. That'll be the decisive thing in the coming Battle of Actium, is competence at sea. So that's the Octavian side. Now, when you go over to Antony and Cleopatra, what you have is wealth. You had the vast naval resources of the East. Lots of places like Phoenicia, Egypt, Greece have naval traditions and contribute ships to the cause. They also have much larger ships. That would have been an advantage under normal circumstances. The battleship of the day was called a quinquereme, meaning five. It had five rowers on the rows, on the oars, three on the top oar and two on the bottom oar. There were basically two oars per side and per bank. And these were the battleships of the ancient Roman navy during the pre-imperial time, during the Republican time. And Antony had a lot more of them. And he had, beyond that, he had these gigantic behemoth ships that have always been part of the Ptolemaic navy that has as many as 10 rowers per oar. And what that really means is you have a massive ship that has to be propelled by more men. So when I say a 10 or a 16, which is the biggest one of the biggest ships ever built, you're talking about a very large ship. Not very tall, unlike Hollywood, which shows that these tremendously tall ships are very low to the water, but they would be broad in the beam and fairly long. So Antony and Cleopatra had a heavier navy, if you will, and both sides had about the same number of troops, about 200,000 men. Most of which would have been legionnaires, though Antony and Cleopatra's force was more light troops drawn from Egypt and other places in the East and less legionnaires than Octavian's force. And that might have been why they chose to fight at sea. It's unclear how many legions Antony actually brought to the field, but they probably were not as good, and they probably were fewer than Octavian. So that may have been why he decided to fight at sea, where he had parity, and thought he had the advantage of bigger ships. So that's the balance of power leading up to Actium. What happens is Cleopatra and Antony marshal their forces in Greece, near Ephesus originally, on the Asia Minor coast. Then they move across into Greece proper, and in preparation of invading Italy, they marshal their forces at Actium, which is a promontory at the entrance to the Gulf of Ambracia, which is western Greece. And by the way, I've been there. I went there back in 97. I actually stood there on the site and visited the site where later on Octavian founded a city composed of his veterans, and he put the rams of Antony and Cleopatra's ships that had been captured on display. And you actually see where those rams were mounted when you go to the city of Nicopolis in Greece. So that's sort of the setup to the battle.
Yeah. Barry, Leslie, let's take a little break, and then we'll continue in the second segment. We want to talk to Aaron Clary in just a minute. But I have a couple of very quick questions. Leslie, you said that Cleopatra spoke seven languages.
Yeah.
My goodness, just what were those languages? I mean,
right off the top of my head, they included Latin, Aramaic, which was the business language of the time. Yeah. And she was one of the few, actually the only Ptolemy who spoke Egyptian. There is a theory, and I subscribe to this because it's based on some references to a cousin who belonged to a priest of Ptah household, that she might have actually had some noble Egyptian lineage intermixed with the Ptolemaic blood, which would also support her desire to learn ancient Egyptian. And she was one of the few who actually went down south to Thebes, to various parts of Egypt. And she was beloved by the country for that ability alone. And one of the other political advantages is brought to her, she didn't need translators to translate dialogue. She could figure out the tone and the content of the ambassadors who brought before her and respond in kind, which made her, in her own right, a very prominent political presence. And it would have been formidable if she was interested in accomplishing something at somebody else's expense. And I think Octavian felt very threatened by her, which led to some decisions we'll be getting on a little bit later on this evening.
Sure. Now, roughly, just so that I can put my mind, what year are we talking about? Roughly, what years are we talking about right now? I know it's BC, but what years are we talking about?
I believe the Battle of Actium itself was September 2nd, 31 BC, so we're very close to its anniversary, so about 30 years before Christ was born, at a time of real dynamic,
right,
expansion and development of the Roman Empire.
And in the year that that Cleopatra died, what year was that?
It followed 39? About the, a year later.
A year later? Okay.
Yeah, 30 BC.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we're not that far from Christ. I guess that's what I'm saying. You know, it's going to sound a little strange, but Christ was just around the corner, I guess. You know, we're 30
that's
years
right.
away from the birth of Christ. And obviously,
it's quite possible St. Joseph was actually alive and kicking at this time.
That's right. Well, let's take a little break, guys, and we're going to bring Aaron Clary, and then we'll continue with our program tonight with Leslie Eastman and Barry Jacobson, and we're looking at some amazing, amazing material from history. We'll be right back. Say hello to Captain Capitalism, also known as Julius Caesar of Minnesota. Is that right, Aaron?
Yeah, I guess so. Did I debunk Mark Payton? That'd be awesome. Yeah, and then I'd be like, you know, a Caesar. There'd be no legislature, and everyone would have to do what I want. And if they don't, then I got the Roman centurions to make sure they all do. Yes, I like that idea. Thank you.
You like that idea. Well, let's say hello to Leslie and to Barry. And you've been traveling a little bit, haven't you?
Yeah, I got back from the Bahamas of Florida, and actually spent the last week here in Minnesota, so kind of recuperating and relaxing and getting ready for fall, which is my favorite season.
Well, everybody in my family found your video about my book very, very funny, very good, and we appreciate it very much.
Oh, no problem. It's good. Have you guys seen the government check dad video or no?
No, I have not. Leslie, have you seen that one?
No, I have to say I've been bad. I've been working on other things, so I'm going to have to do some homework tonight. But that's okay because I'm sure it's just another amazing video from Captain Campbell.
It's 40 seconds long. You'll be laughing. If you're in a bad mood, watch it. You'll be laughing by the end of it.
All right.
Oh,
well,
perfect.
I'm going to make it a point to watch it tonight. Well, bring us up to date, Captain Capitalism. You got books. Bring us up to date.
Well, I'm working on the next book, but I'm leaving the title for that to be tippy-top secret until the release. But meanwhile, people are going back to college. I've noticed an uptick in sales on the book Worthless, you know, because college is starting up. And if you haven't heard about it before or wondering what it's about, it's The Young Person's Indispensable Guide to Choosing the Right Major. And it goes through and explains in very clear economic language, you know, why certain degrees pay more than others. So if you're a student and you got to put $75,000 of your own money down, or you're a parent of students and you got to put $75,000, or if you have multiple students, a lot more money down, this is definitely the book you want to consider reading before making such an investment.
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of articles about this topic. I mean, it's amazing. You know, every time I see one, I send it to you guys. I just sent Leslie one, and I think, I sent both of you one about the cost of tuition and how President Obama doesn't understand why tuitions are up. You know, very interesting article. So how are young people reacting? You say your sales are up because of education. Are you getting any feedback from some of the new readers?
Yeah, there's definitely been a change in just like the less than 2 years it's been out. Beforehand, it was generally negative by young people who've already majored or declared their major, saying, "Oh, you're insulting. You're telling me the liberal arts aren't worth it. I'm stupid." Da da da. And they were unable to separate good advice from their emotions and their dreams. And what I think a lot of kids now, especially as they've seen a young older brother or sister go through it. And no one's got jobs, and all they got is this crushing debt, and they can only make $7-$8 an hour working at Walmart or whatever. The kids are finally starting to wake up. I mean, and you could tell that the kids are starting to wake up because the mainstream media is even waking up to this. I mean, you know, first it's the us bloggers who spearhead the operation, then you have the youth of America, and then finally, when the mainstream media catches on, you know it's happened, and they're a little bit late to the party. But yeah, it's been there's definitely a sea change going on.
Yeah, let me give Leslie a chance to ask you a question.
Well, as much that I concur. We've just had a report about journalism being the most worthless degree. I was able to put a plug in for your book on college insurrection in the freshman year review we just did, which I was really thrilled to do. And again, you're just being proven right on all your assertions as I develop reports for college insurrection. So it gives me good hope that the kids are seeing through the PAP they're being offered at as they enter college and are making much better long-term decisions for themselves.
Right, and I think, Barry, what's important to know is that you never said education was bad. You were just simply giving kids some ideas as to how to spend all that money they're going to spend, that maybe there are some degrees that are not worth it. You weren't saying that education is bad. You were just saying some degrees are not worth it. I think that's what you were saying. What did I do? Did we disconnect somebody here? Who did we disconnect? I'm sorry. I meant Aaron. Forgive me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. No, I meant to say, Aaron, you never said that education was bad. You were simply talking about certain degrees. I apologize for that.
Right, right. No, there's no such thing as a bad education unless you're talking like a vile, the definition of vile leftist indoctrination of hate degrees, like, you know, women's studies, African-American studies, Chicano, where you're basically trained to be a sexist and a bigot. But outside of those, there really is no bad education. No one hurt themselves reading Plato. No one hurt themselves reading philosophy. No one hurt themselves partaking in theater. It's just, why do you have to pay $4,000 a credit to some washed-up has-been or nobody to say, okay, I ordain you, you got credit in this? It's just like, go to your local library, go to your local theater, and do it. So, yeah, there's no such thing as a bad education. There is, however, such a thing as a bad rate of return on your investment.
That's exactly right. Well, tell us where you can get the book, my friend.
Well, all my books you can get on Amazon.com, so just go Amazon.com, search Worthless, or if you want to see what other books I have, just search Aaron Clary. They're available Kindle, paperback, and even Audible.com.
All right, Julius Caesar, get back to your sleep.
Thanks, sir.
All right. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto. Let's bring Barry Jacobson and Leslie Eastman back. Barry, I'm sorry. I was talking to Aaron, and I sounded like I was asking you a question, so forgive me for making that mental mistake. But let's get back to our show. Leslie, take it away.
Well, I'm going to let Barry, since we set the battle of acting up, let's go and describe the battle for our good listeners.
Okay. First of all, I just want your listeners to picture what it looks like on the scene. The sea of around Actium, the Gulf of Ambracia and the Ionian Sea, which is just beyond, is really turquoise in color. It's just a magnificent body of water. And on either side of these two promontories that close off the bay, Antony drew up his fleet. He wanted a narrow space because what had happened while waiting for the battle, I think we left it where Antony and Cleopatra had arrived at Actium and set up their camps and were marshaling their forces. They set up near a swamp, and apparently malaria struck their camp. And a large portion of their rowers were sickened and didn't take part in the battle. And what this did effectively was take away the propulsion system, the engines, if you will, of these big ships. And one of the things that count for the battle were that the normal naval rules didn't seem to apply, where big ships were generally better. Quincrames being the battleships of the ancient world, was that they relied on oar power, which means muscle power, which means that the rowers had to be healthy. So when Octavian and Admiral Agrippa arrive from Italy, and they camp on the northern side of the bay, the northern promontory, Antony's fleet is stricken with fever, with malaria. So when the battle actually begins, Antony sets out with his fleet only partially manned. In fact, he has to burn some ships because he just can't man them all. His men are just too stricken. Both fleets are about 200 ships, roughly. Octavian has a much lighter fleet. His ships are smaller, they're faster, they're more nimble. There are ships called Liburnians, and each one mounts a couple of scorpions, which are, imagine, a very large crossbow, if you will. It's a torsion catapult shooting a bolt that's mounted on the gunwale the forward section of the ships. And Antony and Agrippa will use these to burning arrows, at the enemy ships. And because their ships were so much quicker, they will be able during the battle to dart in and out without ever really making contact, launching these missiles and then withdrawing before they can be grappled, if you will, with grappling hooks by the larger ships of Antony, which are crammed with marines. And that's where the battle progresses, is that the two fleets are opposite each other, with Antony's back to the Ambracian Gulf. He has two wings in the front line, a left and a right, and he had Cleopatra and the Egyptian squadron in the reserve. And facing them are three divisions, all on line, one left, right, and center, of Octavian's fleet. And Octavian, again, has the sea to his back, so he has plenty of room to maneuver, plenty of room to back up. And he uses this to his advantage as Agrippa orders his ships to dart forward and launch missiles. And then when the heavier Cleopatra's heavier ships come forward, again, they're undermanned, so they're slow. They're shot with firing missiles, and many of them catch on fire. At some point in the battle, Antony orders his left and right wings of his first line to attack both the left and right wing of Octavian's line, and in doing so, to push off to the left and right so that basically Octavian is encouraged to counter that by spraying to his right, his left, sitting at his center. And while that is going on, Cleopatra in reserve comes up and penetrates the center of Octavian's line, not to attack it, but to flee. And according to Plutarch, the historian, she lost heart, and in fear she fled, taking with her the treasury on board one of their ships. And Antony, seeing his lover and a third of his fleet running for it, basically, followed with his command ships and abandoned the rest of his forces to Octavian. Now, keep in mind, as well as 200 ships, he had about 100,000 legionnaires watching from the coast, about 30 legions. And it might have been as many as 150,000 men, subtracting the ones who were in the ships. So he abandons most of his forces, which quickly then, once he leaves, join Octavian. It is, after all, a civil war, and these are Romans versus Romans. So when they see their commander leave, they decide to go join the winning side. And
There's one difference I'd like to point out here, and it's a reinterpretation based on maybe a new revised perspective of Cleopatra. And you can comment on it and disagree with me. But her entire family was known for running and hiding and coming back another day to fight. And instead of, quote-unquote, fleeing from Octavius, I would offer that this was actually a design tactic to get her and her treasure ship out back to Egypt so they can fund and fight another day. Because it was apparent to them this was not a likely win for them, especially since they've been sitting in a malaria-infested swamp for so very long. Cleopatra wanted to get back to her country, her source of funding, and her kids. So it was agreed by them to basically distract Octavian long enough for her to go, especially since her ship sailed. We had sails up to begin with, which is not normally something you would have in that sort of battle. Now you can counter that, but that's the view of this battle I choose to have.
Okay, and you're not necessarily wrong, by the way.
Mm.
There is really no explanation for why the Egyptian squadron, which was a very large part of the fleet, just suddenly abandoned the rest of the fleet in the middle of the battle. Plutarch's explanation that she panicked doesn't seem to make much sense. What mitigates it, and what seems to make sense, is that perhaps Antony and Cleopatra realized that they were not going to win this battle. Their ships were undermanned. Their fleet was sick. They had lost the initiative. It may have been a plan all along to kind of spread Octavian's fleet to the left and the right and leave a gap in the middle that she could then escape through, and he would follow her. However, what mitigates against that is that his army didn't march overland into Greece and then through Greece into Asia Minor and then there down to Egypt to join him. The smart thing to do would have been, if he was going to do that, would have been to have Cleopatra flee by sea and then Antony then lead his army overland back to Egypt to keep it from deserting over to Octavian. Because once his army deserted, Octavian had about 400,000 men at his command. There was no way that Octavian would lose at that point. Basically, he had taken over Antony's army. So there are pros and cons to that argument. It seems to make some sense on the surface, but then the inexplicable question is, why did Antony allow his army to
remain in Actium after he fled, if it was a plan all along. So, you know, take your pick, whatever theory you like, but in any case, the results were that Antony lost at Actium because Cleopatra fled, and he fled with her, and then the fleet was picked off one slow lumbering ship at a time, surrounded and set afire. And his army then switched sides and joined the victor, Octavian.
So after that, we get on to Octavian eventually bringing the army into Egypt itself, which gets us on to this, the second part of our topic. And what I'll do is, go over the new theory by Pat Brown offered in the book called The Murder of Cleopatra, which I have read, and you can get on Amazon.com, and it is a really excellent read. And Pat Brown is a noted forensic scientist and criminal profiler, and one of her things she did was do a Discovery Channel, History Channel special on the death of Cleopatra, and she began to question the psychology because she's, of course, a criminal profiler. And what really caught her was that Cleopatra's family was not known for committing suicide. What they were keen to do was make the best of a bad situation, if necessary, flee, but come back and fight again another day. So Pat Brown went to Egypt, investigated the records, and took a look at some of the archaeology associated with the theoretical tomb of Cleopatra and tombs that were built around that area versus, what was described in the records. So I'm going to go through now and discuss the murder of Cleopatra, what Pat Brown determined based on her research that might have actually occurred leading up to Cleopatra's death. And if you take a look at the previous history, Cleopatra had intended to go to India by route of the Red Sea, by building ships along the coast of the Red Sea, but the Nabataeans, who were upset with her for a previous incident, destroyed that fleet. What has been uncovered recently is that there was a channel connecting a branch of the Nile into the Red Sea that would routinely silt up and not be usable except in August. And she had just enough time from that battle to her death to have that channel refilled with water to get it out. But it was just enough time that the Nile was relatively dry. They couldn't get it out any sooner than August of 30th. So there is that component. So as Octavian's army and navy marches into Alexandria, it looks like, based on the records, what thought to have happened is that Antony challenged Octavian. He had his fleet drawn up. He was going to do battle, but all of a sudden the fleet turned around, the army turned around and joined the forces of Octavian. At that point, Antony decided to commit suicide. Brown proposes that's not even in Antony's character either, based on her review of the records and Antony's likely personality. What's more apt to have occurred is Antony was murdered by one of his officers. They wiped blood on Antony's sword, and that was proof that Antony did the honorable thing under Roman standards and committed suicide. That being said, the stabbing was not inherently successful. He survived long enough to make it back into the arms of Cleopatra, where he subsequently died. And Pat Brown also theorizes that Cleopatra, based on what she was able to assess as a criminal profile, was narcissistic. And instead of tenderly bringing Antony into the realm of death, kept on encouraging to get a breath, get over it, and get back to fighting, of course, he then expires. Now, Octavian is entering in, and she wants to deal with Octavian. And Octavian knows that he's got quite a handful with her. But what Octavian is after is the treasury, Cleopatra's enormous wealth. And Cleopatra seems to indicate that she's going to set fire to the treasury unless she's allowed to rule. Well, Octavian is really not having any of it, and decides that he is going to take Cleopatra aside and torture the truth out of her. And Pat Brown discusses those findings in some detail, but the essence of it was the tomb that Cleopatra supposedly used the asp in was not the style of tomb that the Ptolemies would have built, and it's based on the Greek period of Alexandrian architecture. What was described in the writings was actually more of a temple structure. That's point one. And point two, and Pat Brown goes into a great deal of detail on this, is that neither the bite of the asp or the cobra would have induced death in quite the same way as described in the records. And furthermore, it is not likely that a person who's going to commit suicide is going to write out the fact they're going to commit suicide in a note to be handed out later. It just wasn't a likely structure of events according to this criminal profiler. You know, furthermore, as she took a look at everything, there was a whole segment about how Cleopatra was so upset over Antony's death that she beat her breast and tried to really wound it herself, which triggered Pat Brown to think, no. And she tried to replicate the wounds described in the records, and she couldn't do it because it's hard to inflict that kind of pain and damage on yourself. So, you know, that was really concerning. But the other aspect is that the Alexandrian mob was really influential in figuring out who was going to be in charge of Alexandria at the time. And in fact, a ruler just preceding Cleopatra's father, Ptolemy XI, was killed by the Alexandrian mob because that Ptolemy managed to murder a very popular queen shortly after their marriage. So the Alexandrians were high-strung people, and Octavian wanted the treasure and wanted Cleopatra out of the way, but didn't want to upset the mob. So Pat Brown's thinking, given all of this, she suspects Octavian had Cleopatra tortured. He got the information about where the treasury was stashed from Cleopatra, and at that point Cleopatra was put to death. And the story that came out was that Cleopatra committed suicide because she was so in love with Antony she couldn't live without him. Did a couple things. He got the treasury. He had an Alexandrian mob that was satisfied, and he could go on then pay his troops and do whatever he needed to do to then lead the Roman Empire. So that's the murder of Cleopatra in a nutshell, as reconstructed by Pat Brown.
Interesting. Indeed. Interesting. Well, great topic. Go ahead, Barry.
Well, I was going to say that Pat Brown has got a unique theory, and I've read her book, and I found it very compelling. And I don't disagree with that as a possibility by any means. It certainly makes a lot more sense in several of the particulars than the way that the historical record, as told by Plutarch, for instance, has it going. So, you know, it's all very plausible. The net result is that Octavian ends up without Cleopatra to displaying his triumph, but instead has the treasure of Egypt. My only question of Pat Brown's theory is, once she turned over the treasure to him, why did he kill her? Why didn't he take her back to Rome and then display her in his triumph as he would have wanted to do? And for those listeners who don't understand what that term means, the triumph is a parade, a victory parade, that Roman generals recorded throughout Roman history. And it was the highest honor a Roman general could have, was this tumultuous parade in which the victor would ride to the streets of Rome in his chariot, with his army marching behind him, and he'd have a laurel wreath of victory around his head. And displayed in carts behind him in this parade were the captured spoils from the campaign, and various dioramas, sort of like a rose parade, diorama showing the various scenes of the last campaign, the triumphant campaign. And the highest honor you can have, or the most splendid thing you can have, would be to have the captives, usually enemy kings, dragged in chains behind him, golden chains behind him. So here was Cleopatra, and she was absolutely hated by the Roman people and feared. And it just makes more sense to me that he would have wanted to keep her alive and display her to the Roman people. So everything makes sense about that theory until you get to the point of her execution.
Well, I would argue simply that Octavian had a broader vision. And knowing that Egypt was the granary, and knowing that he wanted a much easier transition in ruling Egypt, that would have basically lit a fire under the Egyptians. He did not need to light. Once she died under the aegis of suicide, the Alexandrian mob, as long as they were, you know, going to earn the wealth of Rome and be able to profit, they were going to be chill with Octavian taking over the country. Whereas if they hauled Cleopatra up, given how popular she was and did the triumph, especially under the fact that she was once a friend and ally of Rome, that added fuel to a fire that did not need to get heated. So that's my counter to that argument.
Yeah, fair enough. And like I said, it's a very plausible theory, and your rebuttal there makes some sense. So fair enough.
Yeah. So, but I would just like to conclude just with a few reasons why I think actually Cleopatra won the war. If she didn't win the battle, she actually won the war. And there's three components of my pet theory. And Barry, you're just going to have to humor me as I go through this. The first thing that Cleopatra really, you know, opened up the Roman world to was divine rulership. When she got Caesar in and took him down the Nile, and he became acquainted with the benefits of being a divine ruler. Eventually, the Caesars became divine rulers. So score one for Cleopatra. The next, Cleopatra was viewed as the new Isis. She was Isis incarnate. And given the very bleak afterlife offered by Roman theology, the popularity of Isis worship, Isis, Serapis, and their child, just spread throughout the entire Mediterranean to the point you even had temples to Isis in London. So score two for Cleopatra. But the third reason I think Cleopatra could be argued to have actually won this war is that for an Egyptian, how you ended up living was having your name spoken by people, you know, who are alive. And Cleopatra, think about how many movies and how many representations and how many artwork. And she's just such an iconic presence in all of literature. East, West, she's known. Whereas how many films, how many movies, how many people know Augustus or Octavian? You know, hardly quite as many. So on the score that would have been most important to Egyptian, having your name spoken throughout eternity, Cleopatra clearly won on this account. So I just offer that to kind of tie it in and bring us to the end of a very wonderful exploration of the Battle of Actium.
Well, I will say, Leslie, you're probably right about that. They did make him wonder. How many movies have they made of Cleopatra? Probably a dozen movies or so, right?
I would say much more than that, or, you know, or she's part of a movie or part of a miniseries. God, I have never counted them. You know, and what I find fascinating is Theda Bara, Claudette Colbert, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, and I've heard Angelina Jolie. Every generation seems to have its own version of Cleopatra. In the 1890s, it was Lillian Langtree. And whatever the depiction of an intelligent, provocative, passionate, sexy woman is, whoever that is tends to be the Cleopatra of that age.
You're exactly right about that, Leslie. And Barry, thank you so much. We're really running out of time, but it's been a very interesting conversation. I want to thank both of you for joining me tonight, as always, and it's been absolutely great. Barry, we have a link to your blog. We're not going to have a chance to talk about your blog, but we have a link on the show information, And Leslie, have a wonderful weekend with your family. Barry, the same. Happy Labor Day. We're not going to see you next week, but I know we'll be back the week after. And you've got some great shows lined up. So I want to say thank you to both of you. And thank you so much for being a part of our show tonight, guys. Thank you. It was really good.
Thank you for letting us talk about a topic of interest to us and so many of your wonderful listeners.
That's right. No, look, I'm interested in Cleopatra. After I saw that movie by Elizabeth Taylor, I became a fan of Cleopatra. I'm not sure if I was a fan of Cleopatra or Elizabeth Taylor, but I think I'm a fan of both. I'll put it that way. But thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend, and that's going to have to do it, folks. Thank you so much for listening to our show. And as long as we're talking about Egypt, well, let's leave with the music of John Gilliatt in the sands of Egypt. Good night, Leslie.
Good night, Silvio.
All right, good night. Thank you so much for listening tonight. Great show, great material, good history. That's what we like about these shows with Leslie. She does a great job in bringing history back. Everybody have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you later.